Denise, how are you? And thank you very much for your time today on this podcast.
Thank you. I'm fine. And thank you so much for the invitation.
My pleasure. Denise, I saw from your profile that you have, you have a very impressive profile. You co-founded your company since the last 22 years, and you've been working on it. You are a Harvard grad. My first question, right off the hat, somebody who does an impressive university such as Harvard, normally the opportunities for recruitment are a lot and are very, very important. What made you want to become an entrepreneur instead of following, a normal, I don't know if normal is the word, but like the traditional route of, in consulting or in those big tech companies?
Well, I actually did start in industry after my MBA with the pharmaceutical industry. Mm-hmm. And at one point, I saw the opportunity to create my own company. I think that it's important to have been on the other side to see what clients, future clients of your company, or just what people not in a startup need and how they behave to make a lot of contacts. So it's good to have done both. And there are many entrepreneurs who started in large companies. And usually the story is the same. They wanted to do something on their own rather than on a small scale, rather than being subjected to the sometimes stiff organization of corporate.
I'm always amazed by entrepreneurs because, as you said, so you started in a corporate. Of course, working in a corporate is very different than working in a startup. And as you say, the grass is greener always on the other side. But I have to ask, once somebody is, is a grad from a very big school and does a corporate job, there are some comfort that you have. Like, that your salary will reach at the end of the month, that you will have a good bonus, that you have a career track. And when you go and start your own startup, many unknowns are there. Like what's the decision-making process that somebody like you went through in order, to leave their corporate haven and go to, if I can say, unknown territories?
Well, I think that a lot of it has to do with the question of your mind. If in the corporate world you're not finding the satisfaction that you need, then you're willing to make a leap of faith and say, I can succeed in another way. You're absolutely right. It is much less comfortable. But every day there can be a discovery, a new original source of satisfaction, and it keeps you going.
Yes, I agree. So if you want to resume this, it's a mindset, and you are looking for a certain satisfaction that might come from a startup as opposed to a big corporate. Going forward, when you started, how did you look for the first employees that joined your team? Was it their technical skills? Was it their soft skills? Was it a little bit both? Like what was the recruiting, KPI that you had?
Well, when I started my first company, which was a communications agency, so you're looking for people that have the skills of working in a communications agency and the appropriate personality. It's true that you don't have, unless you've known them from before, you don't have a lot to go on. If you can use an outside opinion, if you can acquire an outside opinion at a price that you can afford, it's always better to do that than just to make a decision on your own. In my very first company, we were two founders, and it was probably, and we're very complementary, different personalities, different experiences, but nobody can protect you from making a mistake about an employee. It happens all the time. So the criterion is that we feel that they responded very well to the questions we asked, that they have the necessary experience, that we enjoyed being with them, And then you see, now it's true that working in France, this is a problem, because if it doesn't work out, it can be very expensive for the company to separate themselves from that person, much more so than in the US.
Yes, and this is something that we've always talking in France, like how much are the entrepreneurs really supported in these things? Because it's true that when you recruit somebody, it becomes very complicated to let this somebody go after a while if there's no more synergy. I want to ask you a small question. During your entrepreneurial experience and years, did you raise funds at any certain point?
I have been on a different track from what the current startups who are creating digital technology are doing. So being in communication, my goal has always been to improve the healthcare system. For a long time, I was aware from a statistical standpoint of the issues of quality, not just as an individual, but both. And I felt that digital health was the way to improve the quality of the healthcare system by matching them with startups and just by integrating tools that would enable them to do better, and also by making information available to the patients. So I did not have directly experience with raising funds, except that I also was in a startup. It was one of the very early second opinion startups. I had brought a potential investor. And so this was before 2000, and we had the dot-com crash. So it didn't happen.
Okay.
So I was also hired by a startup that didn't get its funding. And there I was in a sticky situation where they wanted me to take the position of CEO, and I would have been responsible for the debts after they'd already been incurred by the previous team. And I said, no, thank you. Not going to take that position. Raising funds is easier if you have a track record. I see this all the time. May I give you an example?
Please.
Yeah, so for Doctolib, which is the visible healthcare, the most visible healthcare unicorn, was started by a team that had a huge previous success. It was a consumer service called, which is now called The Fork, but it was La Fourchette.
Yes, of course.
So the founder of Doctolib and of that, and it was a team, had understood through La Fourchette that the way to earn money is really to have it as a B2B company. Instead of having to present himself to the entire French population, it was it was the restaurants that would pay a small sum to be involved, low risk. And he understood that while still offering a service to the consumer, he had to pay very much attention to the loyalty of the restaurants. And when they sold that, they did very well. The owner was able to say to himself, well, now I can do something with my heart. I want to create a healthcare company. And it's true that Doctolib has taken a lot of the friction out of the healthcare system, because people can find an appointment as soon as it frees up. But they used both their reputation to help them raise funds. When you see that there's been a successful exit, then you're more likely as a financier to have trust in this company. And they used what they learned in the field about how to get new clients. And so they really had a whole sales team to approach the doctors, and also in after sales service to make sure that the doctors could integrate this with their agenda, which was, of course, a concern for the doctors. So they knew, they had learned from before how to succeed, and they really hit a pain point, which is the appointments that the doctor loses because the person can't come, and last minute people needing the services of a doctor. Yeah. So it was really very, very successful from that standpoint.
I mean, it's an amazing example, and it shows a little bit how, you know, reality works in today's market. But we do know as well, and we do agree that the majority of entrepreneurs are first-time entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
Those are people that, you know, they don't want to continue doing their corporate job, or they just finished school and they have a solution for a problem and they just want to do it, like they're passionate in doing it. For those people that are typically raising on the angel level or on the seed level, normally the pitch is missing something. I want to take your opinion on that, because you have a lot of experience in the entrepreneurial world. What would an entrepreneur focus on specifically in their pitch? Like, what would you suggest? The one thing they should nail absolutely in their pitch?
Right. I will answer that and complement it with how do they get there? So it's everything. It's going to be the way they walk into the room or appear from an energy standpoint. If it's on a video conference call, it's being very sure of themselves and yet being humble towards the questions that will be asked of them. It's having data that supports their thesis that the market needs XYZ. And if it's in healthcare, the business model is essential. And how do they know that that business model will work? Today, you need a business model that can appeal to the payers, unless you want to go for some very small niche where it's going to be the consumer who is paying and you would have the means to attract them. Mm-hmm. What I have seen is that the startup offer has matured over the past few years because they've observed what's going on and because they've taken advantage of all these accelerator and incubator programs that take a little bit of the unknown out of the equation, because they propose programs and then specific expertise. There are all kinds of programs, ones that will help you find a co-founder, ones that expect you to come already with something, but they will help you develop it. And then often they have consultants on the side who will come in at negotiated prices to help with the specifics. But so there's a lot that comes before. And I ran for a number of years startup contest with my conference, Doctors 2.0. I could tell who was going to win the startup contest. I couldn't tell who would succeed, because we don't know how much of what they say in the pitch is really backed up authentically.
Yeah, of course. Well, I like what you said. Like, you can know who would win, but, you know, it's more on the unknown, on who would succeed. I have a last question for you, and I took a little bit more time than I promised you I would take. What advice would you give to not only French entrepreneurs, but entrepreneurs in general? What would be one advice that you want to share with them, maybe based on your experience or on a previous thing that happened during any of your companies that you work with? What would be something you would advise them? You would tell them, for example, you know, go learn a little bit more in a company, be more prepared, you know, don't start without a co-founder. Like, what would be something you would advise that any entrepreneur should absolutely follow to maximize their chance?
What I have seen is that investors bet often more on the team than on a very specific product, because they know that a lot of pivoting can happen before you reach the market, or quickly after you reach the market. So I think that not only one co-founder is necessary, just from a conceptual standpoint, for you to really have to defend your ideas and have somebody who's got skin in the game, who will, you'll be testing each other on how sound your advice is, but to have complementarity amongst the co-founders. So there might be the product type person, but then there has to be somebody who's more the back office of the company itself, and maybe somebody who's used to raising funds and the financial strategy. And within the world of e-health, digital health, you most definitely need to prove that you have medical competency. So either it's one of the co-founders, or you already create a little group on the side of healthcare professionals that are relevant to your topic.
Denise, thank you very much for your time. It was an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Given your experience, I am sure that a lot of the people that will listen to this podcast or that will watch the podcast will benefit a lot. I thank you very much for your time, and I hope that we will talk again soon.
You are most welcome, Lebanon.